Sana says the U.S. return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is the only proper way to resolve the deadlock in the issue. The Iranian president says that the new U.S. administration needs to abide by UN Resolution 2231 endorsing the Iran nuclear deal. And a study finds that black and South Asian minorities in Britain are lagging behind white people in COVID-19 vaccination. Live from Tehran, this world news, a live broadcast from our studios here in Tehran with me, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, we have some reaction from China. The country is saying that a U.S. return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, is the only proper way to resolve the deadlock over the issue.
China always believes that the U.S. return to the JCPOA is the only way to resolve the deadlock in the Iran nuclear issue. All parties should feel the urgency to work together to implement the consensus reached during the Foreign Ministers' Conference on the Iran nuclear issue in last December, and urge the U.S. side to return to the JCPOA unconditionally as soon as possible while lifting all sanctions against Iran.
Beijing says that the Iran nuclear issue is at a critical stage, urging all parties to avoid taking action that may escalate the situation. Washington withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Tehran. A year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments under the deal in response to the other signatories' failure to make up for the U.S. withdrawal. The new U.S. administration has conditioned its return to the deal on Iran's full compliance. Tehran says it will reverse its commitment cuts once the U.S. returns to the accord and lifts all its sanctions on the Islamic Republic. Now, President Hassan Rouhani has called on the United States to make up for the mistakes of the previous administration.
Hello, millat America fahmid.
The American nation and the current administration there have realized that Trump was wrong. We hope that those mistakes are compensated as soon as possible and the current U.S. administration abides by the law, regulations, and UN Resolution 2231.
Rouhani says it's no shame to abide by the law, adding that the Iranian people will never bow to U.S. bullying. He said all Iran wants from the U.S. is to show respect to international law and agreements. The Iranian president added that he hopes a change in Washington's policy so that Iran could have better relations with the rest of the world, especially in the trade sector. Despite his repeated pledges to come back to the 2015 nuclear deal, President Joe Biden has so far failed either to rejoin the international accord or lift anti-Iran sanctions imposed by his predecessor. Political analyst Heinz Kirchner says that the basis for any talks between the parties to the Iran nuclear deal should be UN Resolution 2231.
Of course, the basis for further talks and a common denominator be the UN Resolution 2231. That's international law, and everybody has to abide by it, and the United States and the other UN powers as well as agree to it. So that could be the basis, and the substance should be to return, of course, to the original JCPOA. The most important thing what they should discuss is that the Europeans get more room of maneuver, that the U.S. should do away, should cancel the secondary sanctions which threaten European companies who wants to do business with Iran. So it gives the Europeans more leeway to act proactively, to maybe also take the lead as they did already in before the JCPOA was negotiated.
Israel has repeated its war threats against Lebanon. It says the country will, quote, tremble in case of a confrontation with resistant movement Hezbollah. The Israeli Minister of Military Affairs says that Hezbollah will take a serious hit in case clashes break out. Benny Gantz says that Israeli troops will be prepared to use whatever force necessary in such a conflict. Hezbollah has warned that any act of aggression against Lebanon could lead to an all-out war. The movement insists it does not seek a military confrontation, but if it's pushed into one, it'll display a resistance stronger than ever before. It wasn't the kind of announcement that Saudi Arabia anticipated, especially Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, even though U.S. President Joe Biden had stated during his campaign trail that he was planning to recalibrate relations with Riyadh Not many anticipated that Biden meant he would be communicating with King Salman rather than his son, or the kingdom's de facto ruler, MBS.
Saudi Arabia could not have it any better. As soon as the former U.S. President Donald Trump came into office, it was evident that he intended to solidify the relationship with Saudi Arabia even more than before. And the businessman that Trump was, that translated into weapon sales to Saudi Arabia.
$533 million.
The Saudis were more than happy to comply. Through their weapons purchases, they also bought the loyalty of the U.S. presidents when it came to their wrongdoings, like their human rights violations, and of course, the Saudi war in Yemen, and the grave violations that were taking place there. The U.S. president even shielded the Crown Prince from the brutal murder assassination of Jamal Khashoggi, which the world condemned as a heinous crime. That included the current U.S. President Joe Biden, an act which may have been the straw that broke the camel's back when it came to Saudi Arabia and the Crown Prince. This may explain why Joe Biden has announced that King Salman is whom he would communicate with in Saudi Arabia, and not bin Salman, even though bin Salman is in fact the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia.
And on Saudi Arabia, I would say, you know, we've made clear from the beginning that we're going to recalibrate our relationship with Saudi Arabia, and that, you know, President Biden, and one of the questions there was also, just to go back to the context of it, whether he would be speaking with MBS. And part of that is going back to engagement counterpart to counterpart. The president's counterpart is King Salman. And I expect at an appropriate time, he would have a conversation with him. I don't have a prediction of the timeline on that.
I think that the significance of this snub of Biden's statement is the suggestion that by the White House or Biden will not consider Saudi Arabia as synonymous with Mohammed bin Salman, but rather seek to establish a relationship with Saudi Arabia that does not uniquely or exclusively depend on Mohammed bin Salman. And of course, that can carry many meanings. At the moment, it just seems to be a statement of significance in expressing the intentions of the Biden administration to rein in Mohammed bin Salman.
The Saudi Crown Prince, however, was forewarned of Biden's stance towards him. Biden used pretty tough language specifically against Mohammed bin Salman during his campaign trail, calling him a pariah. Tough language that the Saudis were not used to hearing. Even though the U.S. President Joe Biden claims that human rights is a barometer when it comes to Saudi Arabia, then why would it sell weapons to other countries, like in the case of Egypt, in which President Sisi is known for rights abuses in that country?
The United States has a host of issues with Saudi Arabia, including war crimes in Yemen, human rights, the jailing of activists, and also the silencing of the opposition. For instance, releasing women's rights activists and other political prisoners has been among demands of the current U.S. administration. Still, the U.S. president has broader and even more ambitious plans for the region than meets the eyes. Although his resetting relationship with the Saudi regime, he's also doing the same with another longtime U.S. ally, Israel. So the question is, what could the reset with both of these allies entail?
Declaration. Victory yet.
The U.S. president has plans for West Asia, or the Middle East region, that goes beyond Saudi Arabia and Israel. The region's security is still very much a concern for the U.S., but regional dynamics and equations may be changing. First off, ending the U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
If the U.S. wants to establish regional security, it will need the Islamic Republic of Iran. The U.S. realizes the military power that Iran possesses. And without this power, the region will be in flux due to tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia and Israel and with the resistance groups in the region. In order for this to be solved, the U.S. realizes that it has no choice other than to rejoin the JCPOA. This can decrease tensions significantly, even though both Saudi Arabia and Israel are not enthusiastic about this, nor do they support it. Iran is also looking for regional stability, but without U.S. presence in the region. This comes in the form of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani's vision for peace called the Hormuz Peace Initiative, or the Hormuz Peace Plan, in order to establish security in the region, including the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz, and the Sea of Oman. This will involve regional countries.
The message coming from Biden is that while we are not lifting sanctions, we are offering concessions in other places, in other issues. And I think for Iran in particular, it's a matter of to what extent can we trust the U.S. to lift the sanctions if we do eventually come to a deal.
But why would the U.S. be after this approach to West Asia? The Pentagon, at Biden's direction, has undertaken a review of changes that need to be made to U.S. military deployments worldwide with an eye towards countering the growing threat from China. West Asia is no longer a number one priority for the U.S. It remains to be seen, however, if the U.S. lifts Iran's sanctions in order for this plan to bear fruit and for Iran to return to the JCPOA. The U.S. President Joe Biden's approach towards Saudi Arabia changing, however, is just a mirage, since Saudi Arabia has continued bombing Yemen and throughout all the previous U.S. administrations, and despite U.S. promises made, the U.S. support has not changed, neither for Saudi Arabia nor for Israel.
Now let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. Indian farmers have blocked tracks and stopped trains at several places across the country. And this is part of nationwide Rail Roko protests against new agricultural laws. The Indian Railroad Protection says extra security measures have been taken in several states. The protests were called by an umbrella body of farmer unions last week. The railroad blockade will be the third major demonstration by farmers following the Republic Day tractor rally and the Chaka Jam protests on February 6th. Tens of thousands of farmers are still camping on the outskirts of the capital, New Delhi, demanding a rollback of the new laws. And this while nearly a dozen rounds of talks between the government and farmer representatives have failed to make any breakthrough. Russia is slamming as unacceptable a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights that calls on Russia to release opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The Kremlin says that ruling amounts to meddling in its domestic affairs. On Wednesday, the Strasbourg-based court asked Moscow to immediately release Navalny, saying that his life is in danger in prison. The ECHR also warned that Russia's failure to release the Kremlin critic would mark a breach of the European Human Rights Convention. The ruling had infuriated Moscow. The Russian Justice Minister called it unlawful, adding that there are no legal grounds for the release. Moscow-Brussels ties have been strained over Navalny's alleged poisoning and his detention on his return from Germany. Navalny was sentenced to nearly 3 years in jail for violating a 2014 parole. Political commentator and member of Germany's Left Party, Bijanta Vesely, believes that the European Court of Human Rights is interfering in Russian internal affairs by politicizing the case of Alexei Navalny.
This is an obvious case of blatant meddling in the internal affairs of the Russian Federation, and they have the European Court of so-called Human Rights has not given any justification except for political talk for why they made this decision. And so this is a complete show trial, and the Russian side is right in insisting on actual legal arguments that we have not been presented with.
Now, Facebook has banned Australians from seeing or posting news content on its platform, prompting a wave of backlash from Canberra and rights groups. Now, that comes one day after a lower house of the Australian Parliament passed the law requiring tech firms to pay for news feeds on their sites. Facebook says it imposed the ban with a heavy heart. However, it has defended the move, stressing that Australian legislation runs contrary to how the internet works. Facebook's decision has drawn sharp criticism from Australia.
This is outrageous and unacceptable. We expect that Facebook will fix these actions immediately and never repeat them again. This is an assault on a sovereign nation. It is an assault on people's freedom, and in particular, it is an utter abuse of big technology's market power and control over technology. This will go around the world, but this stops. This is unacceptable.
Prime Minister Scott Morrison also described Facebook's move to, quote, unfriend Australia as arrogant and disappointing. He warned that his country won't be intimidated by the ban, urging the California-based firm to work constructively with Canberra. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has accused Facebook of censoring the flow of information to an entire country. It says the ban marks a dangerous turn of events and is unconscionable. New research shows that the UK is struggling with racial disparity in COVID-19 immunization. Blacks, Asians, and other minorities are receiving fewer jabs than white people. The study suggests only 55% of black people in England aged 70 to 79 have been vaccinated so far, compared to 86% for white people in that age group. The figure stands at 73% among people from South Asian backgrounds. Now, these ethnic groups have been the worst affected by the pandemic. The data was published in a joint study conducted by the University of Oxford and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Britain has been hit hard by the pandemic, with over 4 million cases and 120,000 deaths. The country has vaccinated around 16 million people so far. Scientists say that a Pfizer vaccine may not be effective against the COVID-19 variant first found in South Africa, which could reduce the antibody protection by two-thirds. Talks with officials and regulators are underway about developing an updated version of their vaccine or a booster shot if needed. The South African government is counting on a Pfizer vaccine for its COVID-19 program, expected about 7 million doses by June. The country's plan to vaccinate 40 million people, or two-thirds of the population, by then. South Africa has logged more than 1.5 million cases of the virus and also 48,000 deaths. The toll accounts for almost half of all COVID-19 fatalities recorded in the African continent. Based on U.S. media reports, the country's diplomats serving overseas are facing a severe shortage of COVID-19 vaccines. According to the Washington Post, some State Department officials serving in Russia have asked the authorities there for the Sputnik V vaccine that's not authorized by the U.S. health regulator. The United States has also accepted offers from 13 countries for inoculating American diplomats with U.S.-made jabs. The report says that the U.S. State Department has requested more than 300,000 COVID-19 shots for the staffers, but has so far received less than one-fourth of that amount. The United States has administered nearly 56 million doses of coronavirus vaccines. It's the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic, with nearly 28 million infections and 487,000 deaths. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello and welcome to The Light. If you walk through London these days, you will spot tiny handmade shops in some places. The shops have been created by an artist to encourage people to donate non-perishable food to charities. Sean Rodrigo makes wooden miniature food banks and puts them in different areas. He uses a 3D printer to create his artwork. Rodrigo believes decorated boxes shaped like shops grab people's attention. Each box holds about 35 cans.
Thai brides and grooms have said, "I do," in a special wedding ceremony on Valentine's Day. 59 couples tied the knot on elephants during the ceremony in Thailand's Chonburi province. The elephant bag wedding is actually an annual event. It takes place in a botanical garden. In previous years, over 100 couples attended the ceremony, but this year, the number was half that due to the pandemic.
It's really difficult and often painful to put a smile into sick kids' faces, especially when they are suffering from chronic diseases. But a group in superhero costumes in Austria has taken a courageous move to cheer up young patients on International Childhood Cancer Day. Vienna Special Forces police officers agreed to visit the children's hospital, dressing up as Spider-Man, Batman, and other superheroes. The young patients were excited and delighted to see them through windows while they scrawled on the walls of the hospital. The officers' brass band also played familiar songs from Star Wars to amuse the children. The visit was planned by hospital officials and volunteer officers in order to cheer up these little warriors who are fighting the diseases every day.
Humans are not the only ones having fun with snowfall. Two giant baby pandas at a Belgian zoo are also taking the advantage of the winter and having a blast playing in the snow. Bao Di and Bao Mi, translated as a little brother of Bao and little sister of Bao, were caught on camera enjoying their first winter at Pairi Diaza. The overly excited, adorable babies were rolling, tumbling around, and even eating in the snow. The zookeeper says that the body of the pandas is in a shape that makes them comfortable in the cold. With the birth of these two babies in August 2019, the privately owned Belgian zoo is now home to five giant pandas. Pairi Diaza is called Europe's best zoo, which consists of botanical garden and an animal theme park.
Chinese villagers cook local dishes as they mark the start of the Lunar New Year. The Chinese New Year is celebrated throughout East Asia and has always been the most important holiday of the year in that region. For many people, it's a two-week celebration culminating in fireworks, red envelopes with gifts, and most importantly, a sumptuous feast. The elaborate meal preparation allows the family to spend more time together and celebrate the new year. The auspicious symbolism of these traditional foods is based on their pronunciations and appearances. Not only do the dishes themselves matter, but also the preparation and ways of serving and even enjoying them mean a lot. In the northwestern province of Shanxi, villagers use a 3,000-year-old recipe to make huamo, a kind of floury steamed bun in a variety of festive shapes, including Chinese zodiacs. As you know, 2021 is the lunar year of the ox.
Australia is offering environmentally friendly kayak tours in Sydney Harbour to both entertain participants and help clean up the ocean. The tours offer paddles, buckets, sieves and picker sticks for removing trash from the harbour. Each month, about 20 such tours take place. They collect around 200 kilograms of garbage. Organizers believe big changes can be made with these tiny steps.
I do feel like we make a difference. It's not. I don't feel like it's just about the rubbish that we pick up, but I feel like it's about sharing a message of what we're doing and I guess teaching people about recycling, using less plastic. I think a lot of people walk around the boardwalk and think that Sydney Harbour is beautiful and pristine, and it is a very clean waterway compared to others in the world, but once you're down here in a kayak or if you go for a swim, you really notice just how much rubbish is down there, so I think it opens people's eyes up.
Plastic pollution has a direct and deadly effect on wildlife. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, 8 million tons of plastic goes into the ocean globally each year. Experts say that by 2050 there will be more plastic than fish in the ocean. People throughout China and in many countries across the globe have begun celebrations marking the start of Chinese Lunar New Year, also known as the Spring Festival. February the 12th is the beginning of the Year of the Ox. Based on the Chinese calendar, a variety of activities featuring traditional Chinese culture and folk performances mark the occasion in China and neighboring states Malaysia, Japan, and Vietnam. Releasing lanterns and setting off fireworks are part of the event. It's also the time for families to be together as the day starts with a week-long official public holiday. The festive mood is also seen in Europe as well as in Australia. Sydney was one of the first cities to kick off celebrations.
It's meant to be a year of economic prosperity, which we need after COVID, a year of good health, which we need so we can, you know, mix and get back to a normal way of life. But it would be good if we had good relations with all of our neighbours.
The Italian city of Milan also joined the celebrations, with its highest building being lit up in red for the fourth consecutive year. Every year, millions of people in China and elsewhere in the world welcome and celebrate the Spring Festival. The occasion attracts hundreds of thousands of tourists to China. However, border closures and travel bans due to the COVID-19 pandemic have reduced the crowd this year, forcing many people to sit home and watch the festivities online. A Canadian man has made art by drawing magnificent geometric shapes on snow-covered fields and frozen lakes. Kim Asmussen first draws a sketch with the help of designing software. Then he puts on his snowshoes to stomp around and make squares, circles and triangulars, among others. Asmussen says 15 to 30 centimeters of snow is needed to make out a design. The man uses a compass and a rope to complete his project. Friends help him too. He began his work last year near Ontario and has so far created 20 snowshoe artworks. The biggest one is around 400 meters long.
Annually, China bursts with colors and lights when the Lunar New Year arrives. This time, an artist has created a gigantic colorful sculpture to welcome the happy occasion. Hu Xingming used clay to make a sculpture of an ox this year, the symbol of the Chinese zodiac calendar. The artwork is the largest of its kind in all of China. It is almost 5 meters long and stands 3 meters tall. Hu says that the piece aims to lift the spirits as his country is battling the coronavirus pandemic.
In the new year, we want to use this ox image to encourage people to win the battle against the coronavirus and get rid of the shadow of the epidemic. We also want to use the flourishing colored ox sculpture to wish our country all the best for its development in the new year.
It took Hu more than 40 days to complete his radiant sculpture. It is adorned with designs that are believed to bring good luck in Chinese culture, such as pomegranates and peaches. The artist says that he will put the ox in public square in his city so that visitors can enjoy the spectacle ahead of the Lunar New Year, which falls on the 12th of February.
A German clinic has trained sniffer dogs to detect coronavirus in human saliva samples with 94% accuracy. Philal, a 3-year-old Belgian shepherd, and Joe Cocker, a 1-year-old Cocker Spaniel, can smell the corona odor that comes from cells in infected people. It's not the virus sending out the odor, but the cell infected with the virus. The clinic's director says the dog's unrivaled sense can enable them to even sniff out COVID patients without any symptoms. Further feasibility tests are required before the sniffer dogs can be put to use in everyday life.
That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
In the limelight.
Congress will move to establish an independent commission to investigate the attack on the Capitol on 6th of January, including facts relating to interference with the peaceful transfer of power. Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California announced on Monday, 15th of February. In a letter to her Democratic colleagues in the House, Nancy Pelosi also promised to move forward in coming weeks with emergency funding legislation for the safety of members and the security of the Capitol, after consulting with retired General Russell Honoré, whom she had asked to examine security on Capitol Hill. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Emily Cochran. The piece is titled, Pelosi Vows to Move Forward with Independent Inquiry into Capitol Riot. Stay with us for more of Emily Cochrane's article. The The U.S. Congress will move to establish an independent commission to investigate the attack on the Capitol on 6th of January, including facts relating to the interference with the peaceful transfer of power, Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California announced on Monday, 15th of February. In a letter to her Democratic colleagues in the House, Nancy Pelosi also promised to move forward in coming weeks with emergency funding legislation for the safety of members and the security of the Capitol, after consulting with retired General Russell L. Honoré, whom she had asked to examine security on Capitol Hill. Security is the order of the day. The security of our country, the security of our Capitol, which is the temple of our democracy, and the security of our members, Nancy Pelosi wrote in the letter, adding that it was clear both from General Honoré's findings and from the impeachment trial that we must get to the truth of how this happened. Calls have grown for a bipartisan independent investigation into the law enforcement and administrative failures that led to the first breach of the Capitol complex in two centuries, particularly after the Senate acquitted former President Donald J. Trump in his impeachment trial on a charge of inciting the rioters. For some lawmakers, such a commission offers the last major opportunity to hold Donald Trump accountable for the Capitol riot. There's still more evidence that the American people need and deserve to hear, Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat from Delaware, said over the weekend on ABC's This Week program, adding that the commission would make sure that we secure the Capitol going forward and that we lay bare the record of just how responsible Mr. Trump was for the attack. Establishing such a commission would most likely require legislation if it were modeled on the 9/11 Commission, which embarked on a 20-month investigation after President George W. Bush signed a law mandating the panel investigate what caused the September 11 attacks and how to prevent a similar attack in the future. The commission ultimately offered recommendations that led to the reshaping of congressional oversight and intelligence coordination. Nancy Pelosi said the panel will be assigned to investigate and report on the facts and causes relating to the Wednesday, 6th of January 2021, domestic terrorist attack upon the United States Capitol complex, as well as the interference with the peaceful transfer of power. A group of House Republicans wrote to Ms. Pelosi on Monday, 15th of February, complaining that she had tapped General Honoré without input from their party, and demanded that she answer questions about what she knew and what directions she gave ahead of the January 6 attack. Republicans have already objected to Nancy Pelosi's decision to install magnetometers outside the House chamber in response to concern about some lawmakers bringing firearms onto the chamber floor. It is easy to understand why we and our Senate counterparts remain skeptical that any of his final recommendations will be independent and without influence from you, wrote the Republicans, including Representative Rodney Davis of Illinois, the top Republican on the House Administration Committee, and Jim Jordan of Ohio, the top Republican on the House Judiciary Committee. Shaken by the siege and riot on Wednesday, 6th of January, which left many traumatized after hiding for their lives in their offices and in the House chamber, lawmakers have also asked to use campaign funds to pay for additional security in their districts. An emergency funding bill would be most likely help fund security for lawmakers in the districts, as well as at the Capitol, which remains surrounded by fencing and patrolled by National Guard troops.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stand here so unafraid of everything around me. Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islam, dini wal-azam ghayru dini, Muhammad il-hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Talk about the laws of business according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, They said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Javid, if somebody, an individual, rents a house, all right?
Yes.
And after a while, it comes to their knowledge, they gather that the landlord, the person who rented the house to the person, to the tenant, in fact, partly paid for the house in riba, all right?
Usury.
Usury, yes. What should this individual, this tenant, do?
Well, Ayatollah Khamenei says that unless it is known that the landlord actually bought the property, purchased the property with the actual money made as riba, there is no problem in making use of that property. So it depends on your knowledge, mm-hmm. Okay? If you know for sure that the house has been purchased with the money, with riba actually, with usury, you are not going to use it and it's not permissible to use that house. But of course, if you do know, and normally you do not know. I think in 9 out of 10 cases, it's very difficult to establish that someone has purchased a given property with usury, with the amount, with usury, pure
yes.
usury, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So since it's not easy, it's of course very difficult, and it's an uphill task to distinguish or to learn that the property has been purchased with riba money, you can use it, the property, and there is no objection.
You mean it's because difficult to determine
to determine, yes.
That usury has been used in order to
of
buy
course.
The house,
it's
for
difficult.
Example.
It's difficult. No, if you see a small quantity of usury has been, and it's also not known because you trust that the usury has not been used. And if a small quantity of usury has been used, that does not affect the transaction, okay?
Uh-huh.
It's the person himself, the person who has taken usury or riba,
he is responsible
for the money which he has illicitly earned.
Uh-huh.
Okay,
I see.
Now I as a user or as a tenant, I am not responsible to investigate whether the property has been purchased with usury or not. I'm not
mm-hmm.
responsible.
I see. You know, in today's world, Sheikh Javid, it's pretty hard to find a job. And some people do it by exaggerating their resume or by faking their qualifications.
Good.
All right?
Yes.
In order to get a job. If they do so, to get a job with a fake document, is their salary lawful according to the rules of Islam?
Well, first of all, I should say that it is haram. It's absolutely forbidden for an individual to to forge a document, okay? Present a forged document to a legal authority,
mm-hmm.
or to, let's say, to someone who owns a company, it is absolutely forbidden. In the first place, to forge that document, and in the second place, to hand over that document, forged document, to a given company or a boss or a government authority, in order to get a job. Mm-hmm. Okay, these two actions are forbidden. Now, when it comes to the job, let's assume that the person gives his documents, and then he is employed. He is recruited by that institution. Of course, His Eminence is of the view that as long as he is capable of doing the job, he is qualified in terms of experience, in terms of handling the job that he has been given. If he is well qualified for that job, of course he does not have the degree, okay? And for that reason, that's forbidden. But if he is doing a job sufficiently satisfactorily, his salary is halal, because he's doing a job that he was expected to do in a proper and in satisfactory way. So the income and the salary that he receives is halal. But for the actions, for forging the documents and presenting that forged document to the authority, that is haram.
I see.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Sheikh Tawid, can a minor carry out a financial transaction if he is able to discern between good and bad?
Well, generally speaking, according to all religious authorities, the transaction carried out by a minor is not acceptable, it's not valid, and of course, you as an adult individual cannot carry out a transaction with someone who is minor, because he has not attained the age of puberty, and he does not know. Of course, there are some good and bad things that he can distinguish, but he does not know what is in his best interest. For example, a child who is 6 years old, 7 years old, or more or less. He does not know what is in his best interest. He thinks that, okay, selling this and getting some money is good, okay? So he does not have the right to carry out a transaction. And if he happens to carry out that transaction, the transaction is invalid, and the person should return the commodity to the guardian of that
minor
individual, okay? It is his guardian who can carry out the transaction in a way which best serves his interest.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Usually people, adults, grown-ups who have come up age, they get deceived through transactions,
yes.
Let alone a minor.
Of course, you are right. If there's a small, insignificant transaction, like, for example, you give 1,000 tuman, or let's say to your kid, to go to a local shop and get an ice cream.
Yes.
That's something everybody accepts.
Yeah.
Even the religious authorities do not criticize.
Yeah.
Because you
this
know the
this is not considered transaction per se, right?
Yeah, it may not be considered a transaction.
I see. Okay, Sheikh Javid, an employee owns a property in the town where he works. He rents it to a person and moves to another accommodation provided by the company he works for.
Yes.
And that, to the contrary, or contrary to the rules and regulations, which clearly states that this is
or this practice is illegal. Mm-hmm. All right? What would the tenant's position be here when he realizes about the employees breaching the law?
Well, first of all, it's not permissible for anyone to move into the properties provided by the company or by, let's say, an institution when they are not entitled to do so by virtue of the rules, yes, and regulations which are in place. But, of course, there is no harm in renting out the property owned by that employee to the other people. And, of course, there is not also any harm in others renting such property and consequently having the right to use the property. So it depends on the law and the bylaws of that company. If the company does not allow the facilities to be rented, then of course it's not permissible to rent, to give it on lease or to rent it out to other people, and of course it will not be permissible for anyone to move into those properties because it's not authorized by the law. Okay, the law, for example, I have been given, let me give you an example. I'm a student of religion. I've given a room to stay in that room. Now I cannot give the same room. I rent it to some other people with because the law of that school or that institution, the Islamic seminary, is a big institution, does not allow me to bring in someone else or to give it to someone else as rent. Mm-hmm. So as long as you are abiding by the law, there's no problem. As long as you're acting against the law and you are violating, you're breaching the law, it is absolutely forbidden.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun la ilaha illa hum ghaffarun jameelun wahhabun latifun tawwabun samiun basir
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.